chapter 4, verses 35 through 41. We'll title this message this evening, What Manner of Man Is This? 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 I don't know where to put the emphases there, but what manner of man is this is the title. Anybody know what the title of the message is tonight? Mark chapter 4, verse 35. Follow along if you would please. In the same day, when the even was come, he saith unto them, Let us pass over unto the other side. And when they had sent away the multitude, they took him even as he was in the ship. And there were also with him other little ships. And there arose a great storm of wind, and the waves beat into the ship, so that it was now full. And he was in the hinder part of the ship, asleep on the pillow. And they awake him, and say unto him, Master, carest thou not that we perish? And he arose and rebuked the wind, and said unto the sea, Peace, be still. And the wind ceased, and there was a great calm. And he said unto them, Why are ye so fearful? How is it that ye have no faith? And they feared exceedingly and said one to another, What manner of man is this, that even the wind and the sea obey him? Now, if I understand the commentaries correctly, and I've read these two chapters of Scripture rather thoroughly, if I understand it correctly, this is the longest day of ministry in Jesus' life. I'm giving you context here. This day began in Mark chapter 4, verse 1. And he began again to teach by the seaside. And that day he spent most of the day teaching. He was teaching by the seaside, and other gospels tell us that he was pressed with the crowd, so he got in a boat and they rowed out a little ways, and he taught all of those parables on the kingdom. And he spent the day teaching. Now we see in verse 35, it was the same day and even was come, but you do not find an end of what is taking place. It is one narrative after another, after another, after another, until you get all the way to the end of chapter 5, verse 43, when it says, And he charged them straitly that no man should know it, and commanded that something should be given her to eat, and that was concerning the raising from the dead of Jairus' daughter. Now, tonight it's not my point to go and cover everything he did in this day, but as I understand it, this day of work includes one daylight day, one all-night voyage across the Sea of Galilee, healing the maniac of Gadara, coming back across the Sea of Galilee. He preached to the multitudes. He ran into Jairus and agreed to go to his house to raise his daughter from the dead. Actually, Jairus just thought she was sick, but he was going to the house to heal the daughter. The woman with the issue of blood touched him in the crowd. Remember, the press was great around him, and she touched him. He stopped and healed her. He went to Jairus' house and raised her from the dead, and he did all of that two daylight days in one night. And the only sleep he took in that time was his nap in the boat as they went across the Sea of Galilee. That's one of the longest uninterrupted days in his life. It began with the teaching of those parables by the Sea of Galilee and ended with healing and raising Jairus' daughter from the dead. So kind of fit this in your mind where this is at. He's taught all day. It's near even. Verse 35, the same day when even was come, he saith to them, Let us pass over to the other side. Now he had spent the day teaching. It's getting dark. I can see the disciples saying, Lord, it's been a long day. Why don't we get some rest and go in the morning? But there's no record here that they argued. They did what he said to do. A good example for us. We should always obey what he prompts us to do. But he wills to cross the Sea of Galilee in the dark. Now that's not a problem for the fishermen. When do you think they fished most beneficially? In the dark. These fishermen were used to fishing all night, so the Sea of Galilee in the dark presented no challenge to them. As a matter of fact, it was a rather routine thing. But after all, they had been up all day. It would have been the natural thing to go to bed, but they didn't. Why do you think Jesus insisted Remember when he said to the disciples as he was ready to leave Judea and go up to Nazareth, he said, I must needs go through Samaria. Traditionally, Jews didn't go through Samaria. They went around. They took the long route and went around rather than go through this forbidden territory of Samaria. But he said, I must needs go through Samaria. And remember, there was a divine purpose for going. In his omniscience, Jesus knew the woman at the well would be waiting there at Sychar. Well, look at chapter 5, verse 1. And they came over the other side of the sea into the country of the Gadarenes. And when he was come out of the ship, immediately there met him a man out of the tombs, a man with an unclean spirit. Jesus knew that the maniac of Gadara was waiting to be healed, waiting to be saved, waiting to be cleansed, waiting to have the demons cast out. And so in his divine timetable, Jesus, after teaching all day, said, let's get in the boat, boys. We need to go across the sea. There's no record here that he told them what the divine purpose was for going, but we must know the Lord always has a purpose. God doesn't do things without a purpose. There's always a purpose. We just need to try to see what it is. So that's verse 35. Look at verse 36. And when they had sent away the multitude, they took him even as he was in the ship. You know what that tells me? They didn't spend any time for preparation. They didn't have the opportunity to. The disciples, when they put him in the boat, they just thought, hey, we're going to listen to him teach, then we're all going to go home and eat pizza. but that isn't what happened. I mean, right after he finished teaching, Jesus said, let's launch out into the deep. Let's go across the sea. And you don't see any argument. They did what he said. But I want you to see here that they didn't make any preparation. They took him even as he was. He didn't go home and take a shower. Didn't go home and put on clean clothes. Didn't go home and pack a lunch. Didn't go home and get any supplies. They just finished teaching and launched out from the shore and went over to Gadara, 7 miles across the Sea of Galilee. Now, generally speaking, I want you to understand preparation's recommendable, generally speaking. But we must be willing to comply with the Master's leading. And there's times that we just need to do what we need to do, and we need to do it now, even though we're not prepared to do it. Have you ever had an opportunity to witness and you weren't prepared? Would you rather say, hey, I would rather prepare a bit before going to talk to that man about his soul. I'd rather think about it and have some verses ready. I'd rather prepare. How many would rather do that? Yeah, but you know what? Sometimes the opportunities do not come that way. And you need to be willing to open your mouth and speak for the Lord when the opportunity serves itself. How many opportunities have we missed because we were not ready or because we did not yield to the prompting of the Holy Spirit? I'm afraid thousands of opportunities in a lifetime have slipped by us because we weren't willing to launch out with the Lord and go when He was ready to go. Those who follow Him must risk what He risks. Those who follow Him must enter into His work, and these disciples were going to follow Him. You know what? The disciples didn't have time to go home and pack a lunch either. You know, Jesus said, let's go to the other side. You didn't hear anybody, you know, pipe up and say, but I don't have a lunch. I want to go home and change shirts. I want to put on a dry shirt, clean shirt. I need to go home and tell my wife goodbye. I need to let my, you know, they didn't have cell phones. Nobody picked up their cell phone, called their wife and said, I won't be home tonight. This crazy preacher has told us we're going to the other side of the sea here. You know, I don't know. He took this wild notion to go to the other side of the Sea of Galilee, and we got to take him over there. That's what I would be doing. I would call Elsie, Brother Fox. Would you call Heidi and tell her you got to go to the other side? But you have a cell phone. Peter didn't have a cell phone. Now it'd take some guts, wouldn't it, to just get in the boat and go, huh? What do you think she's going to say in the morning when you get back? It's awful quiet over there. You know, I was talking this morning. Wouldn't you be able to see what he's thinking? But I'm kidding. But you understand. This was kind of a harebrained thing. It kind of came up out of the disciples weren't expecting this trip. And so I want you to see this. I want you to see they took him as he was. They went without preparation. But the point is, you need to be willing to enter into what the Lord is doing. And that's what the disciples were willing to do. Now, I want you to see this also. Verse 36, there were also with him other little ships. Evidently, there were some other people that had smaller boats that decided, we're going to go where Jesus goes. Now, they didn't know there was going to be a big storm. Jesus knew there was going to be a big storm. I doubt seriously that those little boats had the sailing abilities that the bigger boat that the disciples were in had. Imagine if you had just a two-man rowboat and you get caught in that same kind of a storm. The disciples' boat was full. You know all of those other little boats were full too. Or perhaps they turned around and went back. But the point is, you need to know this. If we follow Jesus, others will follow us. And we need to be careful where we lead them. Okay, these disciples were sailing into danger. Now, the disciples didn't know they were sailing into danger. There was only one man on board that ship who knew they were sailing into danger. That was the Lord Jesus, and he went to sleep. Isn't that interesting? So we come now to the end of verse 36, and we go to verse 37. And there arose a great storm of wind, and the waves beat into the ship so that it was now full. There was problems developing here. Well, I want you to see this. Every task will incur some opposition. Every task will incur some opposition, some contrary force. I don't think very much that we do that counts for much in eternity is going to be without opposition. You know, even walking requires pressing against resistant force. You know, today the young people were playing volleyball. One team had a huge advantage over the other team because the wind was blowing about 15 miles an hour behind their back. And, you know, so they could hit the ball real easy and it just went over the net. The other team had to hit it really hard to get it to go back because the wind was blowing it. There's always a resistant force. You try to do something for God, it's not supposed to be easy. You say, well, I tried serving God once. It was really hard. Well, why do you think not everybody's doing it? Serving God is hard. It's supposed to be hard. I guess it separates the men from the boys, so to speak. It separates the spiritually mature from the carnal. But I want you to understand every task will incur some opposition, but I want you to remember this. With the opposition, remember this. Jesus is omniscient. There are no surprises to him. They didn't get out in the middle of the sea and all of a sudden Jesus said, man, I believe there's going to be a storm blow in. He knew the storm was coming before he said, let's go across the sea. Jesus didn't say, well, I'll be. When the Cardinals came from behind the other evening and won 10-9, I said, I can't believe it. Jesus was not up in heaven saying, I can't believe it. He never said, well, I'll be. He didn't say that. He's never said that once in his life because nothing catches him by surprise. So whenever we run into oppositions in life, remember it was no surprise to Christ. He knew it was coming. Then think about this. Jesus is not only omniscient, he's omnipotent. Therefore, there are no forces of opposition that he cannot overcome. Since he is all-powerful, there's no wave big enough to sink his ship. There's no wind big enough to blow his house down. There's no wolf big enough to kidnap him in the timber. He's all-powerful. Not only that, he's all-present. He is omnipresent. There are no circumstances through which he does not accompany us. Now, there's some things in our lives sometimes that we go through and we feel kind of lonely while we're going through it. But that's our fault, not his. If you're feeling lonely, it's because you've not drawn near to him, not because he's not drawn near to you. Do you understand that? For you to feel the presence of the Lord, you draw near to him. It's like the husband told the wife. Remember, they were driving down the road and the wife said to the husband, honey, remember when we first got married, we used to sit together and I'd sit in the middle and you'd drive and we sat side by side in the car. Whatever happened to that? He said, it wasn't me that moved. I'm still right here under the wheel. You're the one that got too lazy to slide over from the door to the center. Ladies, remember that when you used to get in the car and scoot right over to the middle of the car? And yeah, the bucket seats kind of ruined that, didn't it? But this ship was in jeopardy, or was it? The disciples thought the ship was in jeopardy. It sure looked like it was in jeopardy, but not really. It just seemed that way to the disciples. I want you to know there's many storms in life. Most of them don't have wind and rain, but there's storms just the same. Many of us have gone through stormy relationships. We've gone through fiery difficulties with relationships, and some of us have gone through some financial storms. Others have gone through some health storms. Some have gone through the storms of the loss of loved ones. Some have gone through storms with rebellious children and broken hearts. There's lots of storms in life, but there's not one of them that you ought to walk through or that you need to walk through alone. The Lord Jesus is on your ship every time you sail across Galilee. You just need to mind his presence. Look at verse 38. He was in the hinder part of the ship asleep on the pillow. And they awake him, saying unto him, Master, carest thou not that we perish? Here we are, the worst time in this whole journey, the worst time in 2 days, maybe the worst time in a year. They really, really are scared to death. I mean, these guys are fishermen. They've seen storms. They've been on the boat in the middle of the night, in the middle of a storm before. These guys make their living on the Sea of Galilee, most of them do, and they're scared. They're scared. That's like seeing a tornado watcher scared. You know, those storm chasers run for the storms. But you know it's bad when they get scared and run the other way. Well, here these guys are fishermen and they are scared. And they go to wake Jesus up as if he needed awakened. Well, I want you to see this is the human side of the God-man. You need to always remember about Jesus that he entered into all of our non-sinful attributes. He was truly human. That means he got tired. That means his back ached. I believe Jesus had headaches. I believe he had flus. I believe he had colds and sore throats. I believe he had all the common maladies that go with this human body. An 8-hour, 10-hour, 12-hour day would tire him. 6 days a week, 12 hours a day would make his body tired like it makes your body tired. Jesus entered into all of our non-sinful attributes. So here he is, tired, worn out, exhausted, asleep in the back of the ship. You might say, well, he wasn't afraid because he didn't know what was going on. He always knew what was going on. Jesus knew when he went to sleep. Well, let's see, about the time I wake up from this nap, we should be right in the middle of that storm. Sometimes we think he's sleeping, don't we? We go to the Lord in prayer and we've got a real problem. Our ship's full of water. Have you ever had your ship full of water? My ship's been full of water a time or two, and I'd go to the Lord, and sometimes it seemed like I'd pray, and it seemed like the prayer couldn't get past the ceiling. So I'd pray again, try to boost it a little higher, and it just didn't seem like it was going anywhere, and I thought, surely he must be asleep. But the truth is, he's never, ever been asleep. Why do you think sometimes the Lord makes us work harder to get heard than other times? Do you think it might have anything to do with the fact that we ignored him when things were good? And so maybe he's like a girl that plays hard to get. Guys, you should know this about girls. They always play hard to get. They truly want you to chase them, but they try to make it look like they don't want anything to do with you. And the Lord's not fickle like a girl is, but I want you to understand, many times when things are going well, we don't pray at all. So sometimes the Lord turns things sour and said, now let's see if that'll make you seek my face. But he's not just going to jump right up, because you know what? We've kind of spurned him when things were good, when things were going well, when things were easy. We didn't pay him much attention. And then all of a sudden, now things are bad, we're calling on his name. And I think sometimes the Lord hides just long enough to make us appreciate his presence when he does show up. I remember one time I was a little kid. Mother used to tell me, don't wander away from me in the grocery store. I would have been about the age of Ethan. And I remember this as clear as can be, Heidi. Mother had a navy blue winter coat. And I wandered away from her. I went to where all of the little toy soldiers were, Ethan. I disobeyed my mother. I know you never do that, but I did. I disobeyed my mother, and I went and I walked away from her to where the toys were, and I started looking at the little toy soldiers, and there was a Confederate and a Union set of toy soldiers and horses just about that tall. And there was maybe 20 soldiers on both sides, and I was imagining all of the battles that I could have with those soldiers. If I just had those, I'd be happy. How many of you remember those feelings? If I just had that one set, I'd be so happy. And all of a sudden, I turned around, and my mother was gone. And my heart panicked. And I ran to the end of the aisle, and I looked both ways, and I couldn't find her, so I ran to the other end of the aisle. And I looked both ways, and I couldn't find her. I was really afraid to leave that aisle. You know what she had done? She had gone and hid from me. She hid from me to teach me a lesson. Don't walk off from me in the store anymore. And I went over finally. I got the courage to go to the next aisle, and there was a lady in a blue coat. And I ran up, and I tugged her on her coat. I was so glad to find her. I tugged on her blue coat, and she looked down, and I said, "Mommy, can I have these?" And this kind lady's voice said, "Honey, if I was your mommy, I would buy them for you." Ah! Ah! It wasn't my mommy. Oh, oh! And I began to cry and to bawl. I was panicked because I had walked off from my mama, and Mom taught me a lesson. She hid from me. You know, sometimes when the Lord seems to be asleep, you just stop and think, when was the last time I really had close communion with Him? You know, I've been going on a pretty good, I've been on a pretty good roll here for a while. Everything's been going pretty well for a while. I've been unmolested for a while, and I've kind of gotten away from the Lord. Now all of a sudden I need Him, and I want Him, and I want Him now. And He's hiding. I wonder why He's doing that. You suppose He's trying to teach a lesson? Don't run off from me in the store. Stay by my side. You know, if you stay by his side, you'll always know where he's at. I'm telling you what, after that, I'd go to the store, I'd get a hold of mother's coat, and I'd hang on to it. I was on her like ugly on an ape. I'd hang on to her because I was not going to let her out of my sight. And you know what I've learned? When you get that close to Jesus and you just refuse to get pushed away, you're never going to have those moments where he seems like he's asleep. But it seemed like he was asleep. And you know what? Because of that, because he seemed like he was asleep, because he was asleep, but because he seemed like he didn't care, look at what the disciples said. "Don't you care that we perish?" One of the commentators made a tremendous statement here. Listen to what he said. He said, "You should suspect the validity of the faith of anyone who thinks Jesus doesn't care." You should suspect the validity of the faith of anyone who thinks Jesus doesn't care. Jesus does care. Even if he appears to be hiding from you, even if he seems to be asleep, Jesus always cares. And you know what? You should examine your faith and ask yourself, what kind of faith do I have to accuse Jesus of not caring? I guess that's kind of a natural human reaction. Well, we go to the next verse, verse 39, and he arose and rebuked the sea and said to the sea, or rebuked the wind and said to the sea, "Peace, be still." That's two separate commands. I looked that up in the Greek. Normally, the word peace is the same word. When Paul talks about being at peace with God, anyone know what the Greek word is there? Brother Fox, you probably know this. What's the Greek word normally? Do you know? Irene. And it's spelled in the English, the transliteration is E-I-R-E-N-E, Irene. But that's not the word that's here, it's the word siapo. And it is a command to hold one's peace. It's like saying, "Shut up." Mother would never let me say shut up at home. Every time I told my sister, why don't you just shut up? She'd say, you be quiet. I would say shut up. Mother said, you be quiet. It's a command to hold one's peace. It invokes involuntary silence or inability to speak. It is an active voice, meaning Jesus was making a direct command to the wind. But the word be still is the word phimao, and it means to close one's mouth with a muzzle, that it is to make it speechless. But this is a passive voice, meaning that it's something that he did so that the wind could not do anything. The wind couldn't resist him anymore. The waves couldn't resist him anymore. So he makes the command, and when he made the command, there was like this passive overwhelming. It was almost like the wind is trying to blow, but it can't blow because Jesus has rendered it powerless. Peace! Be still, he says. And the storm stopped immediately. Look at this. The wind ceased, and the tenses and the moods and all of the parts of that word ceased indicate it's an aorist, which indicates immediate complete action that took place in the past. Sometime in the past, it's a done deal. In other words, when he said stop, it stopped. Now, what's the miracle about that is that, you know, if you drop a rock in the water, and you drop the rock, I can say, stop dropping rocks. And if you stop dropping rocks, okay, there's no more rocks going in the water, but is the water going to be still for a little while? How long is it going to take for all the ripples to go away? There's residual action for a long time. But as I understand this miracle, when he said, peace be still, the water went, phew, the wave stopped. The effect of the wind quit. The sound of the storm stopped. It was an immediate silence when he rebuked the wind and the sea. Now let's look at verse 40. He said to them, why are you so fearful? Two questions here that we'll look at. Why are you so fearful? The word fearful is the word delos, and it means to be timid or cowardly. Why are you so cowardly? You know why? I'll tell you why. Their eyes were on the storm, not the Lord. Their eyes were on the sea, a force over which they had no power. It was on the wind over which they had no power. Their eyes were on their ship, and they could tell this ship is not sufficient to hold up. It's not a sufficient refuge for the forces of nature that are taking place. Man, this ship is safe on most occasions, but this occasion is stretching every timber in this vessel. We're in trouble. They were looking at the storm and the sea and the ship, and not even their sailing abilities. They were thinking, you know, Peter is a masterful sailor. John and James are masterful sailors. But even these guys are not equal to this kind of a storm. We're in trouble. They were looking at everything except the Lord Jesus. Is that not a human tendency? We look at, you know, may the Lord help us to quit looking at the stock market arrows. In the political polls. And I'm telling you, you probably just ought to turn off some of the news. I think half of it is skewed. I don't believe half of what I hear anyway. And I know some little old people sit home and that's all they've got to do is listen to the radio and the TV, and they are worried sick. Because the scaremongers make money. That's the only way they can sell news, is to scare people to death. Now, are things bad? Yeah, probably they are. But you know what? Your worry is not going to do a thing to change it. And you know what? Scaring yourself to death by looking at the waves, and scaring yourself to death by looking at the sea, and scaring yourself to death by saying this vessel's really frail, and scaring yourself to death by saying I'm not as good a sailor as I thought I was, looking at your own abilities, looking at your vessel, looking at the wind, looking at the waves, looking at the sea, that's not helping you at all. Look at the Lord. He's the one who has the power over all of that. And eventually, if my bark reaches shore safely, it will be because he guided me through. One of the songwriters talked about his life, and he compared it to a bark on the sea of life. A bark. And that's what some of the old-time sailors called their wooden vessels. They called it a bark. And compared to the sea, their vessel, no matter how well it was made, their vessel looked like bark out on the seas of this world. And you know what? I don't care how strong of a man or woman you are. In this sea of life, your vessel's like a bark. And I have one hope of making it to shore safely. And that is if Jesus Christ is my pilot. And so I urge you this evening, don't do. Why were they so fearful? They were fearful because they were looking at the wrong stuff. They were gazing upon the wrong thing. And then he says, how is it that you have no faith? Now this is interesting because Matthew records them as Jesus is saying, how is it that you have little faith? And Luke recorded it, where is your faith? But Mark is the one who says, how is it that you have no faith? I don't know why there's three different records there. But I want you to understand this. I don't believe Jesus was saying they had no faith at all. They certainly believed that he was the Son of God. They had already said that. They certainly believed that he was the greatest teacher that had ever lived. They already knew that. But I will tell you this, they were having no faith on this day for this venture. And is that not true of us sometimes? We would say, oh yeah, I believe Jesus Christ died on the cross for my sin and raised from the dead, and I believe he's my Lord and Savior. I believe he's going to take me to heaven when I die, but I don't think he can help me pay my bills this month. I don't know that he can help me through this disease. I don't know that he can help my family through this trial. Yeah, I believe he's the Son of God, and I believe he'll save my soul, but I'm not sure he can save my body. Do you understand? There's events that come in life to which our faith is not equal. And this was one of those events for the disciples. And on this occasion, when Jesus said, how is it that you have no faith? He didn't mean they didn't believe anything. But he meant on this day, in this venture, you have no faith. That's really interesting concerning the number of miracles they had observed. They had already seen him in his ministry turn water to wine, heal the nobleman's son, heal Simon Peter's mother-in-law of a fever. He had healed divers of their diseases. He had cast out devils in Mark chapter 1. He cleansed a leper in Mark chapter 1. The sick man of palsy that was let down through the roof in Mark chapter 2, he had healed him. The lame man by the pool of Bethesda in John 5, the man with the withered hand in Mark 3, multitudes by the Sea of Galilee in Mark 3, the centurion's servant was healed at a distance, Luke chapter 7, with the widow's son of Nain, they saw him raised from the dead, and they saw seven devils cast out of Mary of Magdalene, and all of those had happened previous to this occasion. How is it that you have no faith? You've seen me cast out seven devils, but you can't believe me to get this ship to the other side of the sea. You've seen me raise a man from the dead, but you can't believe that I'm capable of giving you safety through this storm. How is it that you have no faith? They lacked faith for the moment because they were in familiar territory. Lots of times in familiar territory where you live, that's the hardest place for you to believe. You know, for instance, the guy who has been a diligent financial planner, and I mean he's invested wisely and he's read all the books and he's done all of his homework and he's managed his money and he's disciplined himself and he's saved and he's planned and he's invested. A lot of times in that familiar territory, he's the guy that has the worst trouble trusting Jesus. A lot of times the guy that lives in the medical field, the doctor, has more trouble trusting Christ than anyone else. You see, the area in which you're the most familiar is the area probably where you're going to be the most tested. And you have to watch it because that's where your faith will fail you. They lacked faith for their need. You know, they could have believed that God would help other people on a ship in the middle of the sea, in the middle of a storm. You know, if I'm on the shore and I see a storm out here and Tom and Daryl are in the boat, I can yell, hey, don't worry, the Lord will take care of you. It's awful easy for me to believe God for them, isn't it? But when I'm in the middle of the sea, now that's a different story. You know whose bacon was in the frying pan here? Peter and James and John and Andrew and the disciples. And now, if it had been 12 other people on that boat, they'd have been standing on the shore yelling, "Hey, yeah, don't you trust the Lord? Take your eyes off those waves. Jesus is on your bark. He'll take care of you." But it's different when it's your sickness. It's different when it's your financial crisis. It's different when it's your surgery. It's different when it's your loss of a loved one. It's different when it's your conflict in relationships. I guess that could be kind of a form of selfishness, couldn't it? You know, the old joke is there's the only people that have major surgery, that major surgery is when it's your surgery. That's the definition of major surgery, you know, if it's happening to you. With other people, it's minor surgery. You know, if it's Joyce having her hip replaced, that's minor surgery. If I've got to have a little wart cut off myself, that's major stuff. It's different when it happens to you. Luke recorded this question as, "Where is your faith?" And I would ask you that, where's your faith? Is your faith in your ship? Is your faith in your sailing abilities? Or is your faith in Christ? Listen, there's different areas where faith is active. You know, some people believe God for their salvation, but they can't believe Him for their sanctification. Or they believe Him for their salvation, they even trust Him for their sanctification, but they can't believe Him and trust Him for their service. That would be the person that would say, you know, I believe God, I believe Jesus died on the cross for my sins, and I believe He saved me, and I even believe He'll help me to walk in the Spirit, but well, I don't know if God could ever help me to go to Africa as a missionary or go to Southeast Asia as a missionary. I'm not sure about that at all. You understand? There's different areas of our life that we find it harder to trust the Lord than others. Well, let's close this up. Go to verse 41. "And they feared exceedingly and said one to another, 'What manner of man is this that even the wind and the sea obey him?'" They feared exceedingly is a really quaint expression. I don't know if I can say this Greek word. It is ephobethesan, phobon, megan. And what that is, it's two uses of the word phobeo, which is the word phobia or fear. But it's one is an adjective, one is a noun. And it's kind of translated or paraphrased, "they feared with a great fear." But that word is twice. It's like a, it's like therefore emphases that Mark put that in that verse twice, that they were afraid. They feared with a great fear. It's the same word, phobeo, but it's two different forms of the same word. They feared with a great fear. You understand? They were really afraid. But this word has a different meaning than the previous word for fear. The previous word for fear meant cowardliness. This word for fear, phobeo, has the sense of reverence. This is not a cowardly fear. This is not a frightful fear. This is a reverent type fear that they are holding for the Son of Man. Matthew Henry said they feared the wind and waves for want of reverence to Christ. Did you hear that? Matthew Henry said they feared the wind and waves for want of reverence to Christ. In other words, if they had have revered Christ, they wouldn't have feared the wind and the waves. Does that make sense to you? I wonder how many times if we would have feared Christ correctly and revered Christ, we wouldn't fear men. The fear of man bringeth a snare. One of the reasons we have trouble passing out tracts and making our contacts is because we have the fear of man. If we revered Christ with the proper reverence, we would not have the fear of man. Does that make sense to you? And then Matthew Henry went ahead and said, now, this is after this, after the Lord ceased the storm, He caused the storm to be at peace. Now they feared the wind and the waves less and Christ more. I remember telling my boys one night, they were crying and howling and bawling in the middle of a thunder and lightning storm. And I mean, it was boom, and you could feel the walls on the house shake. And lightning, you know, and you'd hear the crack of lightning and boom. And it was a terrible electric storm. And they were bawling. And I got up and said, has any of you ever been stricken by lightning? And they said, no. I said, have ever, any of you ever felt this paddle? Yes. I said, you don't know for sure if that lightning or thunder is going to get you, but you know for sure if you don't quit crying, this is going to get you. And so they kind of hushed for a little while until there was another clap of thunder and more lightning, and then it started all over again. Even the fear of the paddle didn't help them be quiet. And I went in there and I told them, I said, God has got big old white angels standing all around this house. And I said, the angel of the Lord standeth round about them that fear him. And if you fear the Lord, the Lord's angel will protect you. Now go to sleep. And went back in the other room, and I heard some quiet whimpering in there. And I went back in, and Levi, I said, what's wrong, Levi? And he said, I don't want no big old angel standing around my house. They feared the wind and the waves less, and Christ more. Matthew Henry went ahead and he said, they feared, now they feared lest they offended him by unbelieving fears. They feared now lest they offend him by or with their unbelieving fears. Do you know if you don't trust the Lord in certain occasions, it's going to be offensive to him? Have you ever trusted somebody rather than offend them? Have you ever listened to somebody rather than offend them? And I want you to understand, that's what the disciples are. They're now at that point, you know what, I don't want to offend the Lord by my unbelieving fears. And so they feared offending him. They feared the power and wrath of the Creator in the storm. They had feared with torment and amazement. But now they feared the Creator more than the creature or the creation. Who creates the storm? The Lord's the creator of all things. He creates the storm. And if you fear the storm more than you fear the Lord, that's not good logic. You think you ought to fear the creator more than the creature, or the creature, or the creation. Now they gave glory to Christ, as Jonah's mariners had done in Jonah chapter 1, verse 16. What manner of man is this, that even the wind and the sea obey him? You know, I don't know that that's a question. I think it's a rhetorical question. I don't think it deserves an answer. I don't think they meant for there to be an answer. It was a statement of awe. What manner of man is this, that even the wind and the waves obey him? Well, he was more than a man. And the wind and the waves did obey him, and we should obey him too. That brings us to an end of our study this evening of this passage. What manner of man is this? He's the Son of God. And you know what? If he has the power to cease the wind and the waves and the storm, he has the power to save my soul, sanctify my life, and seal my service to himself. He can take me through anything that I have to walk through. He is sufficient. Think of our brother Todd Meister, who this week goes into surgery. He is sufficient to guide the doctor's hand and to remove the tumor from Todd's head and carry him forward with a useful life. God has the power to do that. We need to be trusting the Lord through every storm. Now, let me say this. One day it may be you or I that has the tumor. It's easy for us to say, Todd, the Lord will take care of you. You just trust the Lord. That's easy when it's someone else's tumor, isn't it? It's a whole other story when the test lands on our doorstep. One of these days, it'll be me. I've told my wife, I said, honey, you know, we've lived a relatively unmolested life. I mean, most of the problems that many people have had, we haven't had to contend with. Our kids haven't caused us a great deal of trouble. We've not been wealthy, but we've been able to pay our bills. And for the most part, we've had pretty good health. We have a lot to be thankful for. We lost one baby in childbirth. But for the most part, we've been relatively unmolested. But brethren, I'm not naive enough to believe I'll go to the grave unmolested. My turn is coming. I'm long overdue. And I pray that God will give me the grace to bear up like a man when the trial comes. And I pray that for you too. Would you bow with me, please, for prayer?